Welcome to Eastern Standard, a radio magazine about interesting people, places, and things happening in the Commonwealth. Eastern Standard is a community service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of 1, the Altec Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, we'll update you on the very latest in Alzheimer's research. You'll hear my conversation with Ashley York, the Pike County-born, L.A.-based filmmaker who has written and produced a documentary about the hillbilly stereotype. We combine that with this month's installment of our Humans of Central Appalachia series. But up first, something very human: happiness. Being happy is such a time-honored, worthwhile pursuit, the founders put something about not hindering its pursuit in the U.S. Constitution. Achieving it, however, can be quite a challenge, especially if it depends on money. Dr. Thomas Gilovich, a psychology professor at Cornell University, has done 4 studies on the subject over decades and came to the conclusion that happiness is derived from experiences, not necessarily things. He'll be speaking about this at EKU on November 1st and has made us happy here at Eastern Standard with the experience of a conversation about these studies. Greetings, Dr. Gilovich.
Hi.
So it's easy to trivialize the notion of happiness, but tell us why it's important not to.
Well, for one thing, it's related to physical health. People with a more upbeat outlook on life tend to live longer and are healthier. So for that reason alone, one might want to engage in the pursuit of happiness. But also, by its very nature, happiness is rewarding. It almost sounds like a tautology, but it really is that we feel good when we're happy.
What are some common dynamics or some things that get in the way of our realizing our potential for happiness?
Research shows that probably the biggest enemy of happiness is adaptation. Our nervous system has evolved to respond to changes in states rather than stasis. And so we get used to things and they don't have the same impact. And this is a great thing when bad things happen to us. Something terrible comes down the road and we just worry, oh, we're never going to get past this. But by and large, people do. We have an amazing capacity to adapt and get past bad things. So our greatest asset when it comes to bad things is our greatest enemy when it comes to good things. We work really hard to try to get a promotion that comes with a hike in pay, and we feel good for a while, but we adapt to it, and that's the level of pay we feel that we need. We adapt to the extra status and freedom that we have with the promotion, etc. And pretty soon we don't notice it. We buy a new car. It's great to bring it home, and we enjoy it. Pretty soon we don't even much know that it's a new car.
Would it be fair to say that we kind of set ourselves up for a cycle of buying things to make ourselves happy? The new things soon fade into the background. They become part of the new normal. So we spend again and again. Is that a fair assessment of what you've found?
Yeah, certain psychologists have referred to that as a hedonic treadmill, like the rat in the cage running and running and running and staying in the same place. That in many respects we're that way with respect to the pursuit of happiness.
You've done quite a lot of research into something called the Easterlin paradox and the relationship between money and happiness. What are some key findings?
Well, the Easterlin paradox refers to the fact that if you look at the average happiness rating within a country, it's really quite stable. So average levels of happiness in the United States is basically flat since the Second World War, even though we've gotten a lot richer. And so why isn't the extra money buying us more happiness? Or an even better case is Japan, that at the end of the Second World War, by virtue of having lost the Second World War, they were pretty much a third world country, and then very quickly rose to become the second biggest economy in the world, recently eclipsed by China. And despite that massive increase in wealth, average levels of happiness were the same. So this relates to the point we were talking about earlier about adaptation, which is a big part of what makes us happy. We get the new stuff. We get the increased wealth. It makes us happy for a while, but then we adapt to it. Another big determinant of happiness is social comparisons. We compare ourselves to people in our immediate environment, and if the whole country is getting richer, we're still at the same point in the hierarchy. And the looking up at people who have more than you provides the same level of dissatisfaction. If you were making 50 and the most salient comparisons were making 100,000, as it would if you're making 100 and the other person's making 150.
Never ends, does it? Most of us have limited resources, and we need to spend wisely, and that includes what we invest in the pursuit of happiness. Which offers more lasting returns, would you say? Things or experiences?
Yeah, that's something we've studied quite extensively, and we did so because it relates to a dilemma that many people experience. Almost all of us have limited resources, and so we're trying to figure out how best to spend our money. And one calculation we often engage in is to say to ourselves, you know, I could take this vacation, or I could trade in the old car for a new car, or get a new set of bookcases, or a new set of clothes. And people often calculate by saying that, well, I know I would like the vacation or the concert tickets or the meal out, but however much I enjoy it, it's going to come and go in a flash. At least I'll always have the new clothes, the new car, the new bookcases, etc. And that's clearly true from a material standpoint, but psychologically it's exactly the opposite. That is, we adapt again to the material goods. We don't adapt as quickly, or more importantly, as extensively and thoroughly for our experiences. Even though they do come and go in a flash, they live on in the different person we've become by virtue of those experiences and the connections we forge with other people by virtue of those experiences. So as Humphrey Bogart says to Ingrid Bergman at the end of Casablanca, we'll always have Paris. Meaning that, yeah, Paris, their experience was long in the past, but they'll always have it in their cherished memories.
And where happiness is concerned, what's the difference between having things in common with other people versus sharing experiences with other people?
Yeah, that's a great question, because ultimately it's, you know, it's a categorization that we're all comfortable with. When someone says, oh, you should spend on experiences rather than possessions, nobody says, I don't know what you're talking about. We get the dichotomy, but it's not really a dichotomy. There are a bunch of things that, wait, what category would they fall into? A bicycle, it's clearly a thing, but you buy it presumably to go out and ride. It's also a vehicle for experiences. And that's true. And that's true of most dichotomies, by the way. But it presents us with a great opportunity. We could take the very same thing, and we've done this, and get people to think of it like a new TV. Think of it in material terms. Where will it fit in your den? How does it fit the other things in your den, etc.? Or think of it as an experience. Who will you have come over and watch the Super Bowl with you, etc.? And what we find is when they think of it in experiential terms, it has more of the same happiness-producing psychological tendencies than if they think of it in terms of a material possession.
What's your observation? Do you think we do enough as a society to make experiences easier for people to have, to access? And if you don't, what more could or should we do?
You know, there's both room for hope and room for despair. The United States, compared to many other countries, is very taxophobic. We hate taxes more than, and we pay less of them than most other developed countries. And those developed countries take some of those tax dollars and create amazing public spaces. We have some amazing public spaces too, but I think we're underinvesting in them. But I'm seeing some encouraging trends of people taking these rails and turning them into trails, for example, and getting places where people can get out and ride bikes. So the basic point here, of course, is if you grant that experiences make people happier, you want to make it easier for people to have those kinds of experiences. You can't have them if there aren't trails to ride, trails to go hiking, clean beaches, etc. And it's not the private sector that's going to develop those, by and large. It requires a public sector investment to create the experiential infrastructure that will make us all healthier and happier.
Dr. Gilovich, we only have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that I touched on this before we closed. When he was here earlier this year, your friend and colleague at Cornell, Robert Frank, talked with us about the heart attack that he experienced while the two of you were playing tennis, I believe, and how surviving that has left him with this profound sense of gratitude for every waking moment. And the conversation was quite infectious. And I just wondered, did the experience have a similar effect for you? And how does gratitude relate to happiness and a sense of well-being?
Well, yes, it has had the same effect on me. I'm grateful that Bob is generally such a healthy guy, and his general health, I think, helped to pull him through. If he hadn't, if he had died on my watch, for example, I'm sure I would, you know, just be experiencing ever since then a whole bunch of, you know, states of remorse and wondering what could I have done differently or better to have made sure he survived. So the fact that he's such a healthy physical specimen, that one blockage notwithstanding, allowed him to overcome that, and boy, am I grateful that he did, because I'm in a much better state as a result. But the literature on gratitude is it's amazing. I mean, it really is. Forget about the literature for a second. Let's just do a thought experiment. Imagine something that you're very grateful for. Now imagine thinking about that thing, being in touch with what you have to be grateful for, and being in a bad mood. Well, it just doesn't make sense. No, being grateful blocks out any kind of negative emotional state or toxicity. To be grateful is to be elevated. So it increases our psychological well-being. It's related to people sleep better. They're more physically healthy if they're in touch with gratitude regularly. But the most important thing, I think, about gratitude is, you know, most of us are familiar with this phrase of my best self. You know, we try to live up to our best self. We try to get in contact with our best self. And being grateful makes it easier for people to do so. They're more generous to other people, better able to delay gratification, to put off easy enjoyments now for longer term, ultimately more satisfying things in the future. You're just a better person when you're grateful. So it's something we should all strive for.
Cornell University psychology professor Tom Gilovich will visit the EKU campus on November 1st as part of the university's Chautauqua Lecture Series. And Tom, thanks so much, and we'll see you then.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you for having me on.
Coming up after the break, we hear about leading research into ways to prevent Alzheimer's disease. And later in the hour, filmmaker Ashley York on her documentary, Hillbilly. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on the WEKU network of stations.
Thank you.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. It's a given. We all grow older, each and every one of us, and things happen to us just as a consequence of aging. Almost 6 million Americans, for example, are living with Alzheimer's disease. The number is predicted to rise to nearly 14 million by 2050. Care for Alzheimer's patients is predicted to top $1 trillion by about the time children born today are having children of their own. And that's what drives the discussions that take place at the annual Marksberry Symposium on Aging and Dementia. For an eighth year, the University of Kentucky's Sanders Brown Center on Aging is hosting this update on the science of aging on Saturday, October the 27th. If you're listening to our Sunday evening broadcast, it will have just happened, but you haven't entirely missed it. One of the keynote speakers this year is Dr. Sanjay Asthana, director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the University of Wisconsin, and he joins us to talk about new tools in development that make it possible for early diagnosis of AD, the role of estrogen in Alzheimer's disease, and the current state of hormone replacement therapy. And thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Asthana.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And so first, I understand that you have personal experience with Alzheimer's. If you would tell us about that and how it has influenced your work in this field.
Yes, absolutely. So unfortunately, my own father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease at an age of about 63. And I was at that time training to be an Alzheimer's scientist. And I noticed some memory problems in my father. So he was seen by a specialist and diagnosed to have Alzheimer's disease. And over years, he really progressed slowly but quite significantly and started to have the usual symptoms of the disease, quite major memory problems. Eventually, he lost his ability to talk or express himself. And near the last stages of his life, he was unable to care for himself. So I watched my own father go through all the different stages of Alzheimer's disease and had a substantial impact on me about the devastations of the disease and the how it affected my own family, myself, my mother, my siblings. And that became a major drive for me, if you will, to start studying the disease. And I've been in Alzheimer's research for almost 30 years now, with the hope that one day our collective efforts around the world, in the United States and other countries, will eventually win this disease.
I think I'm right about this. I'm speaking for myself here, but I believe that when we reach our 60s, our 70s, we begin thinking about this, about the possibility of dementia later in life. But I wonder how early in life should we really be thinking about this, and what sort of preventative measures might we take?
Yes, and this is a very important question. So as you know, we have been doing Alzheimer's research for quite a few years, and now what we understand is, in fact, the disease process or pathology starts many years, about two or three decades, before someone has the very first symptom of the disease, and usually that is memory complaints. So even, let's say someone has a disease diagnosis at age of 70, in that person, probably the disease started in his or her brain in their early 50s or late 40s. So there's a span of about 20, 30 years when the disease is ongoing, but the person has no symptoms. And this is the time when we can intervene and really stop the progression of the disease or slow it down so that someone never develops the symptom. So the prevention for Alzheimer's disease actually can start at a very young age. And some of the things we know might help in prevention for the disease include healthy lifestyle, that means regular exercise, looking after diseases like high blood pressure or high cholesterol, or if someone has heart disease, then let those diseases be diagnosed and treated effectively, because by doing so, we can really reduce the risk for Alzheimer's disease, and also healthy diet. So if you can implement all these changes or these interventions early on in life, we can significantly reduce the incidence and the risk for Alzheimer's disease.
What are some of the new tools that are coming online to make it possible for early diagnosis?
Yes. So one of the quite significant changes, or rather advances, that have taken place over the last two or three decades include some very special brain scans. So we can actually now do PET brain scans that can be done in many hospitals, including at University of Kentucky right there in Lexington. And we can image some abnormal proteins in the brains of people who may be developing Alzheimer's disease. And these proteins are called amyloid and tau proteins. So through a brain scan, we can actually find out if someone has these proteins getting deposited in their brain. And if that is the case, then we can really start to do some preventive measures, and hopefully very soon we'll have some medications and ways to actually either clear the brain of these medications, of these abnormal proteins, or stop their progression. So imaging is real area in which we've seen advances. And other area is examination of spinal fluid, which we can obtain through a lumbar puncture. And lumbar punctures are done all the time to diagnose all kinds of neurological diseases. What we've learned is that if we examine the spinal fluid, then in patients with Alzheimer's, there are some abnormal proteins that we can detect through spinal fluid exam. So brain imaging and spinal fluid exams are some of the new means we have now to diagnose the disease at a very early stage, even at a stage when someone has no symptoms. And I think this is a real advancement in research for Alzheimer's.
Are we any closer to understanding why women seem to be more likely to suffer from Alzheimer's than men?
Yes, and you're absolutely correct that women are, it seems, at a slightly higher risk of getting Alzheimer's disease. And at least part of that reason may be some hormone changes, especially estrogen hormone changes that take place in women after menopause. There is some evidence from animal research and some epidemiological studies that hormones, especially estrogen hormones and some other hormones as they go down after menopause, that might increase the risk for Alzheimer's disease. Some clinical trials have been done with women after menopause giving estrogen hormone. Some of these trials that were smaller in size perhaps showed some improved effects on memory and cognition, but other trials did not show such effects. So at the moment, we don't have a definitive evidence whether taking estrogen could be of any use for women, and there's no evidence that they reduce the risk for Alzheimer's disease, but there is research ongoing, and they're trying to address those questions.
I've heard about something called biomarkers being used in this science and in this research and treatment. What are biomarkers, and why do we need them?
Yes, these biomarkers are some changes in certain proteins in the blood and the spinal fluid that I mentioned earlier, and also some changes on brain scans. And these biomarkers are the ones that help us decide whether someone has the disease starting when they may not even have the symptoms. So as I mentioned earlier, the special PET brain scans and the examination of the cerebrospinal fluid that we obtain through lumbar puncture, those can be examined for special Alzheimer's-related biomarkers, which really can help us diagnose the disease at a very early stage.
Are you working on biomarkers right now?
Yes, we are, and along with us, I know University of Kentucky Alzheimer's Center is doing the same, and many other centers across the United States. So together, we are trying to find some new biomarkers, especially in blood. If we can identify some blood-based tests, you know, like you go to a doctor to get your diabetes diagnosed, they check your glucose. We are hoping in the future we might be able to do some blood tests to see if someone has Alzheimer's disease or not. So blood-based biomarkers and PET imaging-based biomarkers and also spinal fluid biomarkers. So we're doing those research right here at University of Wisconsin and many of the parts of the country, including at Sanders Brown Center.
Dr. Asthana, what is the state of the art? Where do you see the most promise right now for the treatment of dementia?
you know, that's a pivotal question. And we think that at least part of the treatment will involve clearing the brain of the two abnormal proteins that I mentioned earlier, namely the amyloid protein and the tau protein. And I think the other treatments will come in the form of prevention strategies, perhaps some dietary interventions, certainly regular exercise, leading a healthy life. And we all believe that the best treatment for Alzheimer's disease will not be a single magic capsule or a tablet, but rather it would be a combination of different treatments that can affect different pathologies that go on in Alzheimer's disease. I think the future is very bright. I think the field is moving toward identifying some effective treatments and one day a cure for the disease.
Dr. Sanjay Asthana, director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at the University of Wisconsin and keynote speaker at this year's Marksberry Symposium on Aging and Dementia. Thank you so much, Dr. Asthana.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
If you're listening on Thursday, October 25th, you can attend the Marksberry Symposium. Admission's free, and so are breakfast and parking. 8:30 a.m. to noon on Saturday, October 27th in the Bluegrass Ballroom at the Lexington Center. Registration is required, 859-323-5474, or email paula.thomason@uky.edu. And we know that's a lot of information, and you might not have been able to jot it down, so we've posted it to our website, esweku.com. Just click on the Facts and Information tab. Talking about preventing Alzheimer's, Dr. Asthana said that the disease can start in the brain in your late 40s, early 50s, but symptoms don't begin appearing until you reach your late 60s or early 70s. But intervening in certain ways during that 20-year span can slow, even stop, the progression of Alzheimer's. Dr. Greg Jaika is director of the Telemedicine Cognitive Clinic at UK.
The excitement is quite high. We do think that our best bet and our best opportunities, the most promising medications that we're using currently, are in the area of early prevention or in aborting the process very early on.
I talked with Dr. Jaika during Alltech's most recent One Ideas Conference in Lexington. Some time ago, Alltech and the University of Kentucky's Sanders Brown Center on Aging began partnering on research into the properties of the selenium-based Alltech product AT001. A 2009 study using a mouse model found that the supplement significantly reduced the levels of amyloid plaques associated with Alzheimer's. The FDA approved a Phase 1 trial. That study confirmed that the AT001 seemed to be preventing these plaques from migrating from the spinal fluid to the brain. You now have a Phase 2 trial underway focusing on volunteers with risk for Alzheimer's. Can you bring us up to date on this study?
That's correct. You know, we've had a longstanding relationship with Alltech in moving AT001 forward from the early animal preclinical studies, which not only have shown an impact on reducing amyloid plaques, suggesting a role in the early prevention and or treatment of Alzheimer's, but even later stage changes like neurofibrillary tangles. The Phase 1 study that we performed was really looking primarily at safety. How high could we push the dose of AT001 safely in humans? And we actually found no ceiling on that. We went up to 800 milligrams a day. That's 400 micrograms of selenium. And that is much higher than the USRDA for selenium. But in this particular form, the form produced by Alltech in the compound AT001, safety was not an issue at any dose. We were able to show in that study that we could use the high dose successfully over 12 weeks. And in that 12-week period, we saw tremendous changes in the research participants. We saw an overall reduction in systemic inflammation, that's inflammation throughout the body. And we also saw very positive trends for reduction of Alzheimer proteins in the spinal fluid. We've carried that forward now in conjunction with Alltech in a Phase 2 study. We have large numbers of subjects receiving the medication. The entire cohort is enrolled. Many folks have finished a one-year duration of high-dose treatment with AT-001. Again, we're not seeing any signals suggestive of any safety concerns whatsoever. I am blinded, of course, during the course of the study, so I can't comment on outcome measures as of yet. But I will tell you the last subject out of that study will be this year, December 2018, and we hope to have data available by late winter, early spring next year, which really will hopefully confirm everything that we saw in the phase one study and pave the way not only for AT-001 to make its mark as a supplement for brain health and the potential prevention of Alzheimer-like changes in the brain, but also I know the scientists at Alltech are moving forward always trying to identify the active compounds to purify, to improve the efficacy, the ability of this drug to promote brain health. And so I think we have a long road ahead of us with lots of discovery, and it's a very exciting time for us at the university in this partnership with Alltech.
Dr. Greg Jaika, director of the Telemedicine Cognitive Clinic at UK. And by the way, Alltech confirms that the research is continuing. This month's chapter of our ongoing series, Humans of Central Appalachia, has a particular focus on a particular word.
Let me ask you this. Are you a hillbilly?
Yes, I'm a hillbilly, and I'm proud of it.
And what's that mean to you?
It's my heritage. It's who I am.
Malcolm Wilson interviewing Elizabeth Ramey in the town of Clinton, Virginia.
I love my mountains. I love my home. I love my people.
It's among the more than 400 such interviews Malcolm has collected among people all across the Central Appalachian region. People like Judith Vermillion of Whitesburg, Kentucky.
I love the mountains.
The people of Appalachia have their own perceptions of perceptions, how they're perceived by people who know about them and their culture only by what they've seen and heard in films and on TV.
I think a lot of them think we're ignorant, and maybe we don't know everything, but we're not ignorant. There's a difference.
I believe that would go right back to those same people believing everything they see on TV.
Kevin Howard also calls Whitesburg home.
Yeah, I believe that, you know, negative stereotypes have just, you know, been exacerbated beyond belief, and you'd have to come here to know that it ain't really the case, you know.
And this is where our next guest enters the picture.
I may be the only person from Kemper, Kentucky in Los Angeles.
Ashley York, born and raised in Pike County, educated at the University of Kentucky, and now a producer, director, editor, and writer living in Los Angeles. She may now live and work thousands of miles from Kemper, Kentucky, but Ashley never forgot where she came from. Coming up after the break, a conversation with Ashley York about her documentary, Hillbilly, screening soon at EKU. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on the WEKU network of stations. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. Did you grow up in Eastern Kentucky? Are you there now? Does this sound familiar?
People in California and all these other states look at the hillbillies, like me. They have a certain perception of us because whatever they see on TV.
You hear this comment in one form or another time and again in a documentary about the Appalachian region titled simply Hillbilly. It's by filmmaker Ashley York. She grew up in the Pike County town of Kemper, about 19 miles east of Pikeville. But one day, she woke up and found herself in a faraway land called Los Angeles. Ashley, now a trained journalist and filmmaker, joins us from L.A. to tell us not only how she got there, but also how she has drawn on her Kentucky roots to create a film documentary looking at how the people of Appalachia are perceived in the world at large. Hi, Ashley. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And so briefly, how did a Pike County girl end up making films in L.A.?
Well, I took a very important stop in Lexington, Kentucky, where I attended the University of Kentucky to study journalism. And the University of Kentucky campus was a space that transformed my life and, you know, has everything to do with paving the way for me to move to Los Angeles to do my master's degree at the University of Southern California in the School of Cinematic Arts. While I was a student at UK, I studied journalism and had the great fortune of working in various media spaces, including at the Lexington Herald Leader. I worked for WUKY, I worked for the ABC affiliate as an editor of the TV News, and I was also the editor-in-chief of the Kentucky Colonel during my senior year. So all of those experiences combined gave me a framework for understanding journalism, for storytelling, and inspired me to pursue filmmaking and documentary filmmaking at USC some years later.
And the documentary film Hillbilly is what we're going to talk about. And I'm wondering, when was the seed of the idea first planted in your mind that you would want to do this?
Well, I mean, in many ways, I feel like this is a film that I've needed to make my whole life. Mm-hmm. I have memories of seeing media representations of rural people and Appalachian people going back to being a little girl. So, you know, fast forward many years later to 5 years ago when we started making Hillbilly, I just had reached a point in my career and it just felt like it was time to dive into this topic. Hillbilly is my second film. You know, so I had learned a great deal through living in Los Angeles for 15 years and working for others and working on a wide range of media projects, many of which deal with socially conscious issues. And, you know, I think I had developed the skill set that I needed and worked with so many talented people that I was able to pull together a team to begin producing this project, which has been 5 years in the making now.
And what is its story? What's its message?
Well, Hillbilly is a film that seeks to reach a rich and varied audience that's inclusive of both rural and urban audiences. Hillbilly seeks to challenge viewers' perceptions of Appalachia and offering folks within the region a cinematic portrayal of which they can be proud and opening up dialogue between rural and urban America. It's a film that seeks to expand cultural understanding of Appalachia and rural identity.
As a fellow Kentuckian who's lived out of state, what I'm about to ask you, I think, is something that's been experienced by many of us. Have you encountered these perceptions yourself?
I had an experience here in Los Angeles a few years ago at the Directors Guild, which is an office here in Los Angeles, and I was there for a film festival, and I was standing in line, and I was talking to this fellow about where I was from. You know, he asked, which so many people often do. And when I told him I was from Kentucky, he just launched into singing the Beverly Hillbillies theme song.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of looking at him, not knowing how to respond because it's not funny. And, you know, on the other hand, you know, I'm very careful about, you know, policing people, and it's always hard to know what they're assuming and what they think. But, you know, it's really, really odd the way that folks have this license, you know, to comment on someone and where they're from based on, you know, the way that they speak.
And so in the film, if I understand correctly, you explore where this hillbilly stereotype comes from. What did you find?
We do. Well, we have done a rich and varied we've taken a rich and varied approach to the research, and we've worked alongside the leading scholars in the field, you know, and we've learned that the first time that the term hillbilly was used was in a newspaper in the early, it was around 1900, and a hillbilly was described as a free and untrammeled spirit who drinks whiskey as he pleases and shoots off his gun whenever he pleases. and the person was described as someone living in Alabama. So we, you know, we've tracked these representations back to the first time that they appeared in print. And then, of course, we explore in the film the evolution of the hillbilly image in media and culture, you know, starting in the 20s. I mean, these representations go back to the beginning of film and have persisted over time through the decades. And, you know, they have evolved, and there are many derivatives of, you know, of this person who has gone from being someone who was more like a fool to someone who was more violent, you know, depending on what particular point you're looking at in American history.
Mm-hmm. On your website, hillbillymovie.com, you show a page full of examples of movies and cartoons that have played roles in perpetuating that image. Why has the stereotype endured on screen for so long, not only on screen, but in all kinds of media?
Well, the documentary shows the evolution of the uneducated, promiscuous American hillbilly stereotype in movies and television. And what we found in talking with a lot of the scholars who have been very influential to our process and to the narrative that we tell in the film, you know, we explore how that stereotype and these representations link to the exploitation of Appalachia's natural resources. You know, one of the scholars, Tony Harkins, who's a professor at Western Kentucky University, he talked about this transition that happened and how when rural folks and local folks started to, you know, have a voice with respect to these corporations, the images started to transform to make them appear to be more violent, you know, because anything that stands in the way of progress, of course, is a threat to the goals of corporations, you know, who may have other interests in the region.
We feature a monthly series on Eastern Standard, Humans of Central Appalachia, interviews with hundreds of people all around the region. And a recurring complaint in these interviews seems to always be about being misunderstood, about being thought of as poor and not very bright, the kind of caricature that you've described. How does your documentary address those concerns?
Well, our film seeks to offer a surprising and refreshing view, I would say. And, you know, again, the main goal of the film and the ethos of the film, I would say, is that we want to expand cultural understanding. And the way that we do that is by featuring various folks and groups in Appalachia, particularly in Kentucky, who defy the stereotypes. We spent a great deal of time documenting the Appalachian Media Institute Summer Documentary Workshop, which is a program of Apple Shop, where we got to spend time with young folks there who were exploring a wide range of social issues in the community, including the Black Lives Matter movement the summer that we were there in 2016. Working with those young folks was such a wonderful experience, you know, to see them go into their communities and to learn about their communities and to interact with people that they wouldn't normally have an opportunity to interact with. And one of the young folks, one of the young filmmakers, says that, you know, it's really hard to have to, you know, hide who you are. And it's such a gift to be able to interact with others and to develop this mutual understanding that you don't have to be alone in the world that you live in. And I really, you know, that really moved me. We also had the great benefit of filming with the Appalachian Poets, which is a grassroots group of poets of color living in the Appalachian region. Frank X. Walker, who's a very incredible poet and writer and professor at the University of Kentucky, he was instrumental in bringing that group together to be part of the film. So, you know, I think that featuring these people and these groups really shows the region in a unique way and shows it in a way that is completely opposite of what so many media portrayals represent about Appalachia and this idea that, you know, everybody there is the same and that, you know, there's no cultural or social diversity happening when, in fact, it's just the opposite.
Ashley, I think it's important to point out the depth of the bench that was assembled to make this documentary. The Kentucky author Silas House, for example, is an executive producer, sharing that role with the director, producer, editor, writer, cinematographer Doug Blush, and David Sutherland, whose works have been seen by millions of PBS Frontline and Independent Lens viewers. That seems to really say something to me about the quality of this film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we took great care and time to surround ourselves with people who know the region, who write about the region, who have thought about these issues for decades. I mean, the Appalachian Studies Association was our first stop in the making of the film. And we went there in 2014. It was at Marshall University that year, and Silas House was the keynote speaker. And we met him, and immediately it was so clear to me that he had to be an active participant in the film, both as a subject, but also as someone who we would work alongside in a producing capacity. I mean, Silas House was instrumental in getting Bell Hooks to be a participant in the film. Silas and Chad Berry from Berea College, who had been a tremendous supporter and such a gift to this production. I am so thankful that we were able to partner with so many people who speak in a way that raises consciousness and advances progress, in my opinion.
How can your films, Hillbilly and Her Appalachia, how can they be viewed?
Hillbilly is currently on the film festival circuit. We just showed at the Los Angeles Film Festival, where we won the documentary award, which was very wonderful. And we'll be doing a screening at EKU on the 29th. And we also have a number of other appearances and screenings at universities and in various communities. We do have a distribution partner who will be distributing the film digitally in January. And between now and then, you know, folks will just have to catch it when it comes to their town or city for a festival or a university screening.
But just to reemphasize for people in our listening area, you will be screening at EKU later in the month?
We will. We will be at EKU on Monday night, October 29th. It's an event that is free and open to the public, and it's part of the Appalachia Days series.
Documentary filmmaker Ashley York, thanks so much for joining us, Ashley.
Thanks.
And again, that special screening of Hillbilly, part of the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series, is on Monday, October 29th at 7 p.m. in the EKU Center for the Arts. The film screening is free and open to the public. For more information, go to chautauqua.eku.edu, on Facebook, EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series, and Twitter, EKU Chautauqua.
Kentucky.
Ashley mentioned that writer Silas House played an important role in the making of Hillbilly. And that brings us to a major event being hosted by our content partner, Kentucky Humanities. Silas will be among those presenting at the first annual Kentucky Book Festival, November 12th through the 17th. I dropped by Kentucky Humanities and asked Executive Director Bill Goodman for some festival highlights.
Thanks, Tom. The emphasis there was on Kentucky Book Festival. We are expanding from a two-day book fair to a six-day book festival, and there is a lot going on. And I know because of our time, we can't go over everything, but we encourage everybody to go to kyhumanities.org and look at the schedule. It's there. But Silas House, the many sides of Silas House, we're calling it because Silas is not only going to talk about his documentary, Hillbilly. He'll be there to talk about Southernmost, his new novel, which came out this summer. And gosh, it's done so well all across the nation. Then also music with his partner, Jason Howard, and a young musician and a friend of theirs from Pikeville, Kentucky, who's now in Nashville. Her name is Tiffany Williams. That is our literary luncheon on Tuesday, November 13th from 12 noon to 2. It is a ticketed event, and we invite everybody to celebrate Silas along with us. One of our other highlights is Cocktails and Conversation with Beck Dory Stein. Beck Dory Stein was a stenographer for President Obama in the Oval Office for 5 years. She kept a journal every day of the behind-the-scenes goings on in the Obama White House for that long a period of time. And after she left the White House, she did spend some time with the President Trump administration and then left to write this memoir. And she's a very young and delightful, great person to listen to talk about what goes on And that is, again, a ticketed event, one of the very few ticketed events. That's on Thursday, November the 15th from 4 to 6. That's going to be at the top of Main on Main, which is at the down on Main Street in Lexington. It's going to be a great event. It's going to be a fun event. So we hope everybody will come out for that, too. And then on November 17th, there's so much going on. I had the opportunity to speak to a lot of people just this past few days about how many things are going on at the Kentucky Book Festival on the main day, which is November the 17th. It's almost like a mini Kentucky Authors Forum. There are going to be 180 authors there, and some of the main ones will be Kentucky authors like Silas House will be back. Krista Wilkinson will be there. Bobby Ann Mason, George Ella Lyon. There'll be a number of children's authors, young adult authors. One of the highlights will be at 12 noon on November 17th on the main stage. The University of Kentucky main stage will feature Wendell Berry in conversation with John Parrish Petey, who is the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities. It's going to be a real treat for us to host the chair of the National Endowment for the Humanities, but he is such a devotee of Wendell Berry and of Southern writing. He's making his schedule available so he can come to Lexington and speak to Wendell Berry. It's going to be moderated by Dr. Morris Grubbs, a writer and who works at the University of Kentucky in the graduate school. So he's really looking forward to his trip to Kentucky. I think one of the other highlights, Tom, is at 10 a.m., on the morning of November 17th, the very celebrated and noted Pulitzer Prize-winning historian H.W. Brands discusses his new book, Heirs of the Founders, The Epic Rivalry of Henry Clay, John Calhoun, and Daniel Webster. The Second Generation of American Giants is what the subtitle is. And Dr. Michael Benson, the president of EKU, is going to be in conversation with H.W. Brands. Dr. Benson and EKU have been great supporters of the Kentucky Book Fair and now the Kentucky Book Festival for a couple of years. EKU sponsors our author's reception on Friday evening, November the 16th. Dr. Benson is going to be there as a first-time author. So not only is he going to be interviewing and talking with H.W. Brands, he'll be there as an author with his new book. Again, the Kentucky Book Festival this year is expanding to 6 days, so November 12th through the 17th. On November 17th from 9 to 4 at the Kentucky Horse Park at the Alltech Arena, we want everybody to come out. Of course, on November 17th, that's an entirely free day out there. So come out, shop for books, shop for Christmas books. There are always a lot of people there to mingle with. It's going to be a fun day in Kentucky.
Bill Goodman of Kentucky Humanities on the Kentucky Book Festival, happening November 12th through the 17th. Go to kyhumanities.org for more information. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a community service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of 1. The Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on the WEKU network of stations.